Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Good News Ministries of GNM.org. It's the Catholic place for faith builders. You'll find daily good news reflections on the Scriptures of Mass, written by Terry Modica, to help you in your everyday life and struggles. Visit GNM.org today. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. This week we have with us Father John Bartunek. He received his BA in History from Stanford University in 1990. He comes from an evangelical Christian background and became a member of the Catholic Church in 1991. After college, he worked as a high school history teacher, drama director, and baseball coach, and then spent a year as a professional actor in Chicago before entering the Religious Congregation of the Legionaries of Christ in 1993. He was ordained a Catholic priest in 2003 and earned his doctorate in moral theology in 2010. He provided spiritual support on the set of Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ while researching the 2005 Catholic bestseller Inside the Passion, the only authorized behind-the-scenes explanation of the film. Father John's contributed news commentary regarding religious issues on NBC, CNN, Fox, and the BBC. He's also served as an English language press liaison for the Vatican's 2005 Synod of Bishops on the Eucharist. His most widely known book, and my personal favorite, is called The Better Part, A Christ-Centered Resource for Personal Prayer. His most recent books include a set of books of meditations on the seasons, spring, winter, summer, and fall, Seeking First the Kingdom, 30 Meditations on How to Love God with All Your Heart, Soul, Mind, and Strength. And today we'll be discussing his latest, Spiritual But Not Religious, The Search for Meaning in a Material World. Welcome back to the show, Father John Bartunek.
Oh, thanks. Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, awesome. Now, Father, this book was a little different for me than others of yours I've read. I've mainly read the prayer-related ones, such as The Better Part and the Seasonal Meditation books. So what drew you to writing this particular book?
Yeah, you're right. This is a different type of book for me. Almost everything I've written up to this point has been really designed to help people actually pray or pray better or understand the spiritual life. So this one, Spiritual But Not Religious, is more, it was kind of a response to just so many conversations that I've been having in recent years with people who say this. They say this phrase, "Hey, Father, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious." Mm. And, you know, I used to hear it every once in a while, but I started hearing it more and more frequently the last years. And I started getting curious. So I would try to, you know, people will often say that, like, put it up like a shield. Like, "I'm spiritual, but not religious, so don't talk to me about religion." Mm-hmm. So I kind of started to inquire. I started asking, "Oh, so you're spiritual. Tell me about your spiritual experiences. Why are you spiritual? What happened?" That led to some amazing conversations with people who would kind of qualify themselves as the nons, right, in all the surveys, non-associated, mm-hmm. not associated with any religion. But I began to have these conversations, and they were fruitful, and I thought it would be useful to put into a book, kind of go through what those terms really mean, what people mean when they say them, and kind of try and create a vocabulary that people could use to dialogue with someone who says that, if you meet someone, or to really understand what it really means. So that's kind of the origin of this new book.
So from a 10,000-foot view, let's say, what is the difference between spiritual and religious? Why is it important to make that designation at all?
Well, I'm not sure if it's important in itself, but the fact that so many people do make this distinction I think that that makes it important for us as people of faith to understand it and know how to kind of enter into conversation with it. So 10,000 foot view, when someone says that they're spiritual, what in general, in my experience, what they're talking about is they've had some sort of experience in which they can't explain by simply material causality. You know, they've had some sort of touching of something transcendent where a portion of their own soul, their own heart has been moved, usually by some sort of some encounter with something that's true or good or beautiful. They've been deeply moved by it. They kind of touch this transcendence, transcendent realm, and they want more of it. When you have that experience, you want more of it. Now, when someone says that I'm spiritual but not religious, what they, in my experience, again, what they're usually saying is, okay, I like that spiritual experience and I want more of it. But in my experience, people who are religious in the sense that they go to church regularly, they buy into certain dogmas and certain moral codes. I meet people who are religious and they don't seem to be spiritual. They don't seem to have had an experience of the transcendent. So I don't want to become religious because then I might have to lose my spiritual experiences. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of from their perspective, what those terms mean. But I think there's deeper meanings as well, which I go into the book, which we can talk about if you want. But.
Right. Yeah. And one thing you talk about is that the two should be, in my own words, live in harmony, be cohesive. They should be together. You can't really have one without the other. And in one chapter, you make the statement, which I thought was perfect, is that religion that doesn't have spirituality is a lifeless shell. So why is it important those two coexist and that they're together?
Yeah, that's a great question. So authentic religion is never just about following rules or a moral code or kind of believing a list of dogmas or just, all those things are part of religion, but they're meant to be linked to a relationship with God, right? That's actually what we want and what we crave as human beings. So if you meet someone who's religious, but they're kind of like the Pharisees, they check off all the boxes, they go to church all the time, they know their catechism, but they're not actually living a real relationship with God, then that can actually be a turnoff for people. You know, it's like just like the Pharisees kind of were a turnoff for people in the time of Jesus, right? So ultimately, if you understand spirituality as an experience of the transcendent, then if I'm honest, if I had that experience and I want more of it, I've got to start asking myself some questions. Wow, where did this come from? What's the source of this transcendence? And how can I live my life in such a way that I'm more deeply kind of in contact with it, more constantly in harmony with it? So those two questions, the only way to answer them is through coming up with, you know, discovering some doctrine, some dogma, some truths about who God is, and so a moral code, a code by which I can live in harmony. So authentic spirituality is the beginning, and a spiritual experience is the beginning of a journey, which if I'm honest, because I want more and I want to stay plugged in, will lead me to some kind of religious faith. And authentic religion, if I'm really, you know, always involves a relationship with God. So relationship with God is contact with the source of all transcendence. So that's why, as you said, they're meant to be in harmony and cohesive. Mm-hmm. So the division between them is artificial.
And as you get deeper into the book, and we can actually dovetail this question off something you just said there, you talk about how all religions aren't the same. Why is that important to consider in this conversation?
Oh, yeah. So this is it's one of my favorite chapters in the book. Well, there's two chapters where I kind of talk about this, but in these conversations that I have with people, and we talk about spiritual but not religious, and often a very common affirmation that people will make is, well, in the end, all religions are the same anyway, right? It's like they're all basically the same. So in the book, I that's the title of one of the chapters, as you point out. And the answer I give is, you know, aren't all religions the same anyway? The answer I give is actually a little bit surprising. I say, well, actually, from one perspective, they are all the same, but from a different perspective, they're not all the same. And this is important topic to talk about with someone who is spiritual but not religious, because it can help them continue their search. So what do I mean by that? Well, if we as human beings are created for transcendence and for relationship with God, then the deep questions that every human heart asks, where do I come from? What's the meaning of my life? What happens after we die? Why is there evil? How can I live? How can I find happiness? These are deep questions which are universal to every human person. All the philosophies through the centuries, all the right. So those questions are always the same. Every human heart has them. Every religion answers or tries to give an answer to those deepest questions. So from the point of view of we all ask the same deep questions as human beings, from that point, all religions are the same. They're all asking those questions, trying to find answers to those same questions. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if we're honest and humble in the face of different religions, we have to realize and recognize that the answers that different religions give are different. The answers they give to those most fundamental questions are different. So from the point of view of the questions, all religions are the same. From the point of view of the answers that they give, they're very different. Mm. So they're both the same and different.
Right, absolutely. Now, also, the one thing that I know I see it, I'm sure you do, many of us listening today do, what are your thoughts on society's efforts to somewhat erase religion totally, making it back burner, saying it's insignificant?
Yeah, well, this is a trend that started in the Enlightenment. I mean, we're going back to the 18th century here. And there's a whole kind of a history to the development of the secularization of our society. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the default position for the worldview of people, in, at least in Western culture now, is that God, even if he exists, is irrelevant. I mean, just watch, you know, all the popular TV shows. How many times does a family stop and pray? How many times, you know, just very, very little, right? So mm-hmm. The default position is that even if you're religious, well, it's basically irrelevant. And that's a secular society. I mean, I really think it's a post-Christian culture. We talk about a culture with a shared worldview, a shared hierarchy of values. And the ones that are popular, the ones that are shared, are, you know, no longer really Christian. You see it in many different places. But that's one of the reasons why I felt like it might be worthwhile to write this book, because the tone that I take in the book, or I try to take in the book, is not an accusatory tone. I'm not assuming that everyone should have a Christian worldview, and if they don't, they're just messed up. What I'm assuming is nobody has a Christian worldview, or, you know, that's not the default position. So let me meet you where your worldview is, and let me try and help you continue to journey towards what is truly true, good, and beautiful, which in the end is Jesus Christ. So the tone I try to take is a tone that isn't accusatory, but really kind of sincerely interested. I mean, if people aren't Christian, then we can't pretend that they are, right? So mm-hmm. We got to meet them where they're at and help them move towards Christ.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be right back.
Who are the models of faith in your life? Who helps you hear God's call? The women God called to bring His chosen people into the world were ordinary women who struggled with emptiness, oppression, infertility, and loss, yet who found strength and hope in God. In her first book, Sarah Christmeyer, co-developer of the Great Adventure Catholic Bible Study Program, pairs the stories of key Old Testament women with stories of women from her own life to show us how we can hear God, say yes to His call, and share Him with the world just as they did. Check out Becoming Women of the Word at AveMariaPress.com or look for it wherever books and ebooks are sold.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. Today with us, we have Father John Bartunek, and we're talking about his latest book, Spiritual But Not Religious, The Search for Meaning in the Material World. And we dropped off last segment speaking about religion. Also in the book, you had an interesting section where you talked about people forgetting spiritual experiences they've had. You refer to this as spiritual amnesia. Why do you think people sometimes forget these experiences, or is it more so that they just don't recognize them?
Well, I think both happen. Although, you know, if you have a spiritual experience, and then you kind of, you know that you had it. Mm-hmm. When you kind of contact the transcendent, whether, you know, you're hiking in the mountains and you have this experience of God's beauty, you know, the beauty of God's creation, or maybe deep suffering, a loved one, and your relationship goes to another level when you're dealing with loss, or there's different experiences that can lead, you know, different things we can experience that put us in contact with transcendence. So the real question is, well, if you talk to, you know, most people have had some sort of deep, meaningful experience in their life. But oftentimes, as you mentioned, they don't really allow it to become part of the landscape of their mind. They just file it away and maybe even forget about it. Why? I think there's a couple different reasons. One is that the world in which we live is so noisy, and there's such this lava flow of information and entertainment, and it is so easy to live on the surface of things. So just as, you know, T.S. Eliot put it, the beginning of the 20th century, to be distracted from distractions by distraction. it's just so noisy. There's, you know, this video and that video and social media and this and that and the fast pace of society. So when we live on the surface, we don't really give ourselves space to reflect deeply on our own experience of life, which is an important part of any spiritual life, even for Christians. We need to do that. It's funny, in the Bible, one of the complaints God has about his chosen people throughout the Old Testament is they keep forgetting about all these amazing things he's done for them. Right? Mm-hmm. So there's a, you know, that's kind of part of our human nature, we have this tendency to forget. So that's one of the reasons it's so noisy. But another reason is, if I'm going to be honest with myself after I have a deep spiritual experience, then I'm going to start asking myself these other questions, which I already mentioned. And, well, gosh, where did that come from? You know, and why did I experience that? And what does it mean for me? That requires, to be honest, ask those questions honestly, requires me to keep searching. And the search, that type of existential search, is demanding. I'm demanding kind of on my mind, on my heart. And sometimes we're just lazy. You know, we just don't want to have to, and I'm going to keep things simple. I don't want to have to ask the deeper questions. And that's part of our fallen human nature. The traditional word for that is sloth, spiritual sloth. Mm-hmm. You know, it just requires effort to continue to search for deeper meaning in life. And, you know, there's so many alternatives that I can just be distracted and live on the surface of life. Sometimes I just don't. And that's why sometimes it takes a crisis to really jumpstart someone in their search for deeper meaning. Those are a couple of the reasons, I think, why we can get this kind of spiritual amnesia.
Mm-hmm. Another great chapter that I thought was timely for the situation we find ourselves in our own country is the chapter on spirituality and politics. And there's a few things that we can pull out of that chapter. First, you state that politics is not solely about politics, but rather about ethos as well. Can you share some thoughts on that with us?
Yeah, so we're actually being created in God's image. And God is a trinity, right? Three persons, one nature. So we are created to live in community. The family is the natural community, the cell of all other societies. But families come together to form tribes, and tribes come together to form communities. And the history of humanity is a history of we always live in community. We're created for that. So politics is simply, like, at its most basic level, the real, like, healthy, true politics is simply, well, if we're living as a group in a community, we have to have a way that we make decisions together as a group that affect everybody. And politics is really that. I mean, the word comes from polis, which is the city-state of ancient Greece, right? We live in a community. We've got to have a way to make decisions together for the good of the community. Because if the community is healthy as a community, then the individuals who live there are going to have a better chance of living a meaningful, fulfilling life. So I think that's the place to start. Right, we have to recognize that there's a purpose. Politics isn't just news and infighting and that kind of thing. We actually live together in community, and we seek a common good together. So that's kind of where I start in politics, and everything else kind of flows from there. In the sense of a political system should respect authentic human nature, and when we live in community, we experience the goodness of that. So that's kind of the link between, that's kind of the link to the spiritual aspect of it, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to have the values that we share as a community, the values which determine how we make decisions together, that those shared values, that's the ethos, that's the worldview. That's kind of the what we as a community value. And so some of the questions that come up there are, well, who actually is a member of this community? A child in the womb, in a mother's womb, is that child a member of our community or not? Someone who, you know, is at the end of life and they, you know, they're not mentally sharp anymore. Are they still a member of our community? Well, how do you, the shared values that the community has, the ethos, the worldview, determines how they answer those types of questions. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the relationship between politics and ethos, I think.
There's a, you close that chapter with this few sentences. It says, a search for meaning in a material world includes building a healthy society, and a healthy society depends upon a spiritual vision that takes a religious stand either knowingly or unknowingly. Politics is not just about politics, just as economy is not just about economy. And then you state, undergirding all of this common life is an ethos, whether we want to admit it or not. So part of that, it seems like we have to have some kind of spirituality, some kind of religion in our societies, but we have the political realm telling us that we can't have that. So how do we interject that into our society with that front against us?
Yeah, I don't think there's an easy silver bullet type of answer to that, but that's a critical question for the church as a whole. In a post-Christian society, how does the church kind of, how do we as members of the church, and how does the church as a community act as, you know, salt of the earth, light of the world, leaven in the dough, to use images from the gospel? How do we do that? And I think, me personally, I think we can learn a lot from the first generations of Christians. Now, the first generations of Christians, they lived in a religious society, but the religion was paganism, Roman paganism, polytheism, right? Kind of a syncretist polytheism. So the ethos, the shared values of the wider society, was that Roman paganism, polytheism. And the Christians didn't share that. So, but they became, by living faithfully the gospel values and the faith that they had received, Christians in all different walks of life, living those values, witnessing to those values, even giving their lives to be faithful to those Christian values, gradually they transformed the wider culture of ancient Rome so that eventually it became a Christian society. It took hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. It took waves of martyrs. But it took Christians being faithful to their identity and their mission as Christ ambassadors in all walks of life in ancient Rome. I think in our post-Christian culture, that's the way it's going to happen. We have to be faithful to our own call to be holy and to be Christ ambassadors in the world, wherever we go, wherever he sends us, and through his providence. Gradually, I think we can re-Christianize the society. I don't think it's going to be a quick fix. It's a question of that kind of faithfulness and that kind of love. Every individual one of us, and as families and as communities, doing that, the Christian community together as leaven in the dough of this wider post-Christian society. Mm.
In another chapter, Spirituality and Entertainment, you brought up a thought that I had never thought of. We often talk about people searching for something to fill the great longing they have, fill that hole, God-shaped hole. And when we do this, we often point to the things we consume. But in that chapter, you suggest there's spirituality in such things as music, movies, sports, and other forms of entertainment, which is oftentimes what we tag as being the wrong things to fill that God-shaped hole with. Can you give us a little overview on that chapter and why there's spirituality in those things as well?
Yeah, so in the chapter on entertainment and the spirituality and entertainment, really what I'm getting at there is, like, in a certain sense, you know, people love good movies, good TV series. People love sports. The sources of entertainment move us. We enjoy them. Sometimes we're even inspired by them, especially as young people. You know, I'm inspired by a great athlete. I'm inspired by a great movie. You know, Star Wars makes me want to go have adventures. Mm-hmm. So there's something in the world of entertainment. Entertainment has always been around as part of human culture since the earliest times in various forms. And music, right? People love listening to music, my favorite music, my favorite style, my favorite artist. It moves me. It moves me at a certain level. Now, in this chapter, I said, well, if that's the case, we should reflect on why. What's going on there? What is it touching in my soul? And I think great art, now there's art that's not so great, right? But great art traditionally presents to us truth, goodness, and beauty under the form of some kind of a story. Even a song has a beginning, a middle, and an end, kind of a story there in the music. Even you know, classical music, the structure of a symphony, right? So it presents to us truth, goodness, and beauty in the form of a story. And when it presents it, and that sometimes can move us more deeply than a philosophical argument or a syllogism, or at least move us in a different way, right? We need both. So my point is, well, let's reflect on the experience that we have as we benefit from and enjoy entertainment and ask some questions. Where does that come from? Why is that? And the fact of the matter is that life itself is a story. Each one of our lives is a story. The history of salvation is a story, the story of salvation. God revealed to himself to us in the story of his relationship with his people in the Old Testament and by entering into our story through the incarnation, right? So the structure of our own existence in time as we make our way towards eternity is kind of the structure of a story. So those experiences of entertainment can actually be clues to help us understand the deeper meaning that we're called to experience in our own lives. That's kind of a summary. I don't even know if, mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to click on some of those ideas, but it was fun to write that chapter because I think everybody can identify with, you know, being moved by those sources of entertainment, especially when they're high quality art.
Right, right. Absolutely. Well, we're going to take another quick break. There's plenty of more to cover in our last segment. We'll be right back. We're with Father John Bartunek talking about his book, Spiritual But Not Religious.
Marriage is ordered between one man and one woman because, like God's love, it is called to be fruitful, open to life. Well, there's a lot of confusion in the culture today, but here is some clarity in the following beautiful quote from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, 2335. Each of the two sexes is an image of the power and tenderness of God, with equal dignity, though in a different way. The union of man and woman in marriage is a way of imitating in the flesh the Creator's generosity and fecundity. End quote. Listen, be not afraid. Couples that are willing to live openness to life in their marriage will receive not only many spiritual benefits, but a very practical strengthening of their marriage. I'm Jim Littleton, FormingFaithfulFamilies.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. Today we have with us Father John Bartunek. We're covering his latest book, Spiritual But Not Religious, The Search for Meaning in a Material World. And as we wind down, Father, we'll touch upon a few of the other chapters. And another significant one in the book was your chapter on spirituality and suffering. We all know we live in the fallen world, and because of that, we have suffering. How can we effectively deal with suffering?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one to answer quickly. there's actually a section in the Catechism which talks about the whole revelation of God in Christ, the whole story of Christ is God's answer to the problem of suffering. So there's no quick fix here. Mm-hmm. But in that chapter, I think, you know, a lot of times, when people are resisting God's invitations to continue to search, to continue to go deeper in spirituality, they find something spiritual that they like and that fits into their lifestyle, and so they want to stick with that, but they don't want to continue to search. And in this chapter, I kind of challenge. I said, well, wait a minute. You know, if you're finding meaning, and you think, then you have to take into account the fact that, well, there's also suffering and evil and darkness in the world. It's not all, you know, just not all fun. And there's in the book, I actually use some paintings from the Detroit Institute of Art as examples of kind of an expression of spirituality in art. Mm-hmm. And in one room in the Detroit Institute, there's different paintings which show different forms of suffering and evil. Someone having a nightmare with a devil present there, someone being tempted by the devil, and then another one where a storm comes and their loved one in the flower of youth is just killed, right? So these are realities that we all face. So whatever answers you give to the deep questions of life, the meaning of life, have to take that into account. You can't ignore that. We have to say, okay, well, this is true, so I've got to find, how does this fit into my worldview? How does this fit into meaning? And a lot of people won't answer that question. So that's one of the angles I take in that chapter. And the other one is, sometimes the confrontation of suffering, especially very deep suffering, can open us up to the transcendent, because we realize that the material world around us isn't enough, because things pass, things get broken, people die, sickness comes. So there's, what more is there? Yeah, and I have a sense that's wrong. There should be more, right? So the experience of suffering can open us up to continue our search as well.
You also look at, on the flip side of that, spirituality and goodness. And within that, you had an interesting segment where you talk about pursuing recognition and how that can be a bad thing. We think, you know, being recognized is good, but the pursuit of it can be bad. Can you dive into that a little bit for us?
Yeah, so in the chapter on spirituality and goodness, I talk a little bit about the experience that we've all had of a job well done. When I've done something and I've done it well, I get some kind of sense of satisfaction from that. Everyone, I think, can identify with that to a certain degree. I say, well, where does that sense of satisfaction come from? And so I kind of reflect on that. And one of the answers you can give to that is, well, I do a good job and, you know, people approve, they compliment me for that, and I feel affirmed by that. So that can be one. That can be a source of the satisfaction. And I said, well, yes, that's definitely, we're meant to live in community, right? So if we do something that benefits others and they recognize that, that can be very rewarding. But even when no one sees me, if I do a good job, do something well, and no one else ever sees it, I still have that sense of satisfaction. So where does that come from? It comes from the fact that we're actually created to make a positive difference in the world. You know, when God created Adam and Eve, put them in the garden and gave them a mission, right? So when we do something that's creative and positive, and even, you know, physical labor, we do something well, that gives us satisfaction because we're actually fulfilling our mission. So that, and goodness is when something achieves its potential, when it is fully what it's called to be. That's a kind of a philosophical way of understanding goodness. So we don't want to forget about that, and we want to reflect on that. And if we start to do things just to get recognition, then we actually unplug ourselves from this important aspect of being human, which is simply to do good because we're created to do good, to actually make a positive influence, regardless of whether or not people recognize it. Mm-hmm. But I think I talked a little bit about, you know, how if we're searching for recognition, we can start doing things. We can lie, we can cheat, we can deceive just to get recognition.
Right.
So then we're actually contradicting the goodness that we're created to. So that can be really dangerous.
Absolutely. You also take a look at death in the book. And we know that after death, for us, our belief tells us there's something much greater than this world can provide awaiting us. I'll ask a question you asked because I think it deserves some discussion. How does one prepare for death if this post-Christian society we live in believes nothing comes after death?
Yeah, well, that's one of the big problems with a post-Christian society. You know, you don't really, if you think that this world is all there is, then you kind of just try to avoid thinking about death. You know, you try to kind of squeeze as much pleasure as you can from life while you're alive. But if there's nothing afterwards, then, you know, and that kind of explains the whole euthanasia thing. So I think, and yet in the back of our minds, especially like if anyone who's had a loved one who has died, you miss them. Well, you know, if the only thing that exists is this material world, why would we miss someone when they die? I mean, that should be so natural, right? But we miss them. So that even the experience of death, the death of others, or the experience of tragedies, you know, when there's an earthquake and so many people die and there's so much suffering, like, there's something in us that says, there's something wrong with that. Well, okay, we've got to reflect on that then. But why? If death is so natural, why is there something? Why do we rebel against that? Why do we have this instinct that says, there's got to be more? And then the whole history of humanity is kind of wrestling with that as well, philosophy and different religions. So I think one of my points in that chapter or in that section of the book is really, you know, let's be honest. Let's be honest with ourselves and face this. Okay, I know I'm going to die. And so how am I going to deal with that? What does that mean for me? What does that fact mean for me? And I think I tell the story in that section. One of my first jobs as a teenager, I worked in a cemetery as a 16-year-old in the summer, cutting the grass, putting in the headstones. And it actually led me to think a lot about that, to start thinking about the meaning of life. What am I going to do? What's going to actually – there was even a little inscription on the headstone. I think I reproduce it in the book, you know, all you who passed me by, as you are, so once was I, as I am, so must you be, prepare for death and follow me. And I remember just kind of memorizing that, that headstone and thinking, gosh, you know, that's true. I'm going to die someday. I never thought about that. Wow, what does that mean for me? And so that contributed to my own spiritual journey. And that's my point there. You know, we can't ignore this, right? So you have to find, if you're going to be honest, you need to find a satisfactory answer for, well, what is the meaning of all this if we're all going to die? So that's part of the spiritual journey and the search for deeper meaning.
So kind of in that vein, we also live not only in the post-Christian society, we live in the fake news society. We're constantly trying to discern truth because of that. How do we go about doing that, and how does truth impact our spiritual life?
Yeah, well, truth. Yeah, those are two really good questions. I think, first of all, regarding the whole fake news, and that ties in a little bit with the noise that we were mm-hmm. talking about earlier that's yeah. all around us. And, you know, now it used to be there were only 3 channels on TV and you only had 1 newspaper in your town or maybe 2. So you were very limited in your access to information. So you're kind of at the mercy of those who were giving you the news. But now there's so many different sources and so many different avenues. It's actually, if we use it intelligently, proactively, and find sources that we can trust that talk to us about things that are important to us, then it's actually the current environment is actually really beneficial. But if you just kind of let yourself get caught up in the flow, then you know that's going to contribute to living superficially and not going deeply. So that's one thought. But then the role of truth here again. Like the kind of the default position of people is that truth is relative, right? What's true for you is true for you. What's true for me is true for me. And let's just, get along and not bother. As long as you don't hurt me, you can do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. But nobody actually lives by that. When it comes down to it, there are certain things which we say, those are bad. In the physical sciences, it's very clear. We accept truth, right? You're going to, I want my doctor to know where the liver is if he's going to do an operation, right? Mm-hmm. I want him to know it's objectively true. This is where the spinal cord is. If I cut this, something's going to happen. So there's objective truth in the sciences. But for some reason, in this culture, in the moral area, we tend to be, whatever's true for you, but no one can actually live by that anyway. So, but the point here is that truth as well, the experience, learning something, coming to know something as true, gives me an experience of being enriched. Like if you think about it, when you actually learn something, I never knew that before, you feel enriched. Well, how does that happen? It's because my soul, my spiritual soul, is meant to know truth, to discover, to understand things deeply. I'm meant to do that. And there's all kinds of, I'm meant to become wise. And so I experience a certain satisfaction when I learn, when I really do have an encounter with what is true, just as I do when I encounter what is good and beautiful. So that's an important aspect to have in mind, to think about the experiences I've had when I actually learned something and to open myself up to continue to grow in my knowledge of what is true and what is good. That's how I'm enriched spiritually. And there's all kinds of different types of knowledge, but that's how the pursuit of truth contributes to my spiritual life.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we mentioned when we opened this interview, this book is a little different than other things you produced. What is your greatest hope for this book?
My greatest hope. I would love for this book to get into the hands of every Catholic who's living their faith intentionally, so that they can be better equipped to share what they've received with people who've given up on religion. That's the first hope. So I would love to see, just to help those who are living our Catholic faith and trying to live our mission, to help us really reach out to other people and not discount them, know, to really be proactive. And then secondly, I would love for this book to just be handed out to people who say, I'm spiritual but not religious. And I would just say, read this book and then let's talk about it. Because there's more to discover. There's more. And that's kind of the subtitle, right? The search for meaning in a material world. If someone can read this book and then kind of reignite their search, I'll be happy. Just keep searching. Because as Jesus said, if you're really searching sincerely, you will find. He's going to find you. And too many people have kind of given up on the search and stopped halfway.
Mm-hmm. Where can people find Spiritual But Not Religious, The Search for Meaning in a Material World?
Yeah, well, it's available on Amazon and wherever you buy your books. And you can find more information about it on the website where I do these online retreats as well, rcspirituality.org.
Excellent.
So, yeah, you can find information there.
So thanks so much, Father John, for taking time out of your schedule and spending it with us again today. Any closing thoughts?
Well, just thank you, Peter. Thanks for your good work. I mean, I think this is a great service that you do, kind of unpacking some books and keeping us all up to date on what's out there. I really appreciate that. And I think it's very helpful. So congratulations and keep up the good work.
Thank you. And with that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger. And until next time, God bless.
Who are the models of faith in your life? Who helps you hear God's call? The women God called to bring His chosen people into the world were ordinary women who struggled with emptiness, oppression, infertility, and loss, yet who found strength and hope in God. In her first book, Sarah Christmeyer, co-developer of the Great Adventure Catholic Bible Study Program, pairs the stories of key Old Testament women with stories of women from her own life to show us how we can hear God, say yes to His call, and share Him with the world just as they did. Check out Becoming Women of the Word at AveMariaPress.com or look for it wherever books and ebooks are sold.